Among the literary portraits of American fascism garnering renewed interest since last November, Margaret Atwood's 1985 novel, The Handmaid's Tale, is probably the best known. Indeed, its nightmare of reproductive injustice is so familiar that signs at the Women's March earlier this year could simply allude to it, with slogans like, "Make Margaret Atwood Fiction Again," or "Noliti de Pastardes Carborundorum," also a popular tattoo. Activists in Texas recently protested proposed further restrictions on abortion access by dressing as handmaids. The novel has been variously banned, translated, and adapted, including multiple dramatic adaptations for radio and stage, a ballet, an opera, a 1990 feature film, and most recently, a 10-episode series on Hulu. I'll avoid spilling details about most of the ways the current television version departs from the novel, but I don't think that knowing the story's basic situation detracts from the impact of either the book or the series. So, mild spoilers ahead. The Handmaid's Tale describes a near-future American theocracy in which environmental pollution has led to widespread infertility. The patriarchal regime that takes over portions of the United States and renames it Gilead imposes a totalizing system that dictates clothing, ritual, and family structure. The few women who are still fertile are assigned as handmaids to the families of powerful commanders and their wives. Publicity for the series has stressed its timeliness while acknowledging its updating. But while many of the inevitable changes from the book work well, displacing and condensing elements for clarity and visual impact, dramatizing moments unrepresented in the novel, and elaborating on the experiences of secondary characters, one problematic change has been evident since the previews revealed the protagonist's friend Moira is played by Samira Wiley. The attempt to make the setting post-racial runs counter to the political history of the United States, the details of the novel, and the ostensible goals of the change. Among the small number of writers to critique this choice, I'm drawing here on points from Susan Rensing on Nursing Cleo, Soraya McDonald on The Undefeated, Priya Nair in Bitch Magazine, and blog posts on Fangs for the Fantasy and by Aberdeen Dadaboy. In the novel, the Gilead theocracy is racist as well as sexist and homophobic. The excuse for the imposition of martial law that leads to the Gilead takeover is a supposed threat of Islamic terrorism. African Americans are relocated to the Midwest to homelands imagined as resembling those of the apartheid era in South Africa. Dissidents of various sorts are either executed, their hanged bodies often displayed for days as a warning to others, or sent to clean up the toxic wastelands known as the colonies, apparently a slightly slower sort of death sentence. But only white women become handmaids. Some critics have faulted the novel for this. The book gets some of its frisson from imposing on white women some of the oppressions imposed on enslaved black women in the antebellum South, and the tropes and imagery of U.S. chattel slavery. Women in Gilead are forbidden to read, write, or congregate. They're treated as property, valued for their reproductive capacity, named for their owners. The central character is called Offred because her commander is named Fred, of Fred, Offred. Those escaping to Canada are helped by a secret network known as the Underground Female Road, and many of their allies are Quakers. Offred's narrative, like many 19th-century slave narratives, originates in oral form. But while Atwood's novel thus arguably obscures the intricate relation of racism and sexism by silently transposing races, centering a white woman's experience by taking what happened to African-American women under slavery and imagining a near future where white women experience forced breeding, the book does acknowledge the racism of Gilead. In the far future epilogue, an historian looking back at Gilead notes that the regime's racist policies were firmly rooted in the pre-Gilead period, and racist fears provoked some of the emotional fuel that allowed the Gilead takeover to succeed as well as it did. For the Hulu series, however, executive producer Bruce Miller decided to cut out the white supremacist ideology of the Republic of Gilead, saying that he made the decision that fertility trumped everything. But of course, concerns over the birth rate and population have always been about whose fertility and the fear of being overrun by someone else's babies. The religious right first got traction as a political movement not in trying to stop abortions, but in trying to stop racial integration. White supremacist groups worry that interracial marriage constitutes white genocide, because it taints Aryan purity. Stormfront and similar sites fret about whites being outbred by non-whites, and the Quiverful movement encourages Christian white women to breed incessantly. So the change is implausible in relation to the racism of real history. And it's implausible to suggest that it presents a post-racial world. As Ambarine Tadapoy points out, if this were truly a world devoid of white supremacy, would all of the wives of the commanders be icy blondes or pale gingers? Compounding this is the fact that other than Moira, the other black and brown bodies are both scarce and light-skinned. In fact, if fertility did trump everything, then I suspect we'd see a lot more brown people than we do. It's not as though there's evidence white women are more fertile than others. At the very least, we'd see equal distribution of races within the ranks of the handmaids. Finally, the lingering and loving gaze of the camera lets us know how much the narrative is invested in white suffering and white pain. We're treated to long close-ups of delicate white faces forced to wince and blink at unspeakable atrocities. It's their pain we're asked to witness and with which we should identify. We're asked to identify with the suffering of these women on a fundamental level, on a universal level, on a human level. In trying to rationalize the series' casting choices, producer Miller asks, what's the difference between making a TV show about racists and making a racist TV show? Why would we be covering the story of Handmaid Offred rather than telling the story of the people of color who get sent off to the Midwest? I want to suggest there's potentially a great deal of difference between making a TV show about racists and making a racist TV show, and the possibility that Miller presents this as a rhetorical question should cause concern. In the terms that Miller tries to set up, there is indeed no good reason that Offred herself need be played by a white woman. And since we've begun to see the series develop scenes and characters not followed in the novel, there's no good reason we would not follow those who were exiled to some homeland. But for those visions, as Priya Nair argues, we need to turn not to the work of Margaret Atwood, but to that of Octavia Butler or Octavia's brood. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel.
Divided that come together to stand united. The voices of toiling masses gather, our voices heightened. We want our lows lightened, we want our wrongs righted. Any attempt to control our bodies, we poised to fight it. Gon' blame the system, that's accurate. But if we claim our inaction, that's activist. Our body's not a target, yet it's under attack. Forward together, never a single step back.